have Betsy Esch, who is a student at NYU and is with an organization here called Students for Justice in Palestine. She lived and worked in the occupied territories in 1990 through 91, and she was a student organizer for the National Campaign for Peace in the Middle East. And she is going to talk to us about U.S. policy within the region of the Middle East.
This is cool. I'm happy to see you all here. I'm freezing, so I'm going to try and not be shivering while I talk. So as Becca said, I'm going to try and say some things that I think will be useful about U.S. policy in the region, and by region I mean in this instance the Middle East. I'm not going to talk particularly about Afghanistan or South Asia. Christian sketched out some of that, and I know you've all been reading and studying a lot. I'm going to try and talk more about some of the U.S. policy that I think has laid an important context for understanding how we got to where we are today and how we might emerge from it. So, and I also will try to be brief. On August 6th, 1945, the United States dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima, which killed more than 100,000 people and left generations after that suffering from radioactive fallout, from diseases and conditions and deadly living conditions, which remain until this day. Another atomic bomb was dropped several days later on the city of Nagasaki. On August 6, 1990, exactly 45 years to the day later, the United States imposed economic sanctions on Iraq. This was in response to Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, which took place on August 2, 1990. And it was designed to cripple the Iraqi regime who had carried out the invasion of Kuwait through destroying the country's infrastructure and putting pressure on regular citizens to get at the elite who run the country through hurting the poorest people in the country. Imposed 4 days after the war began, they were then reaffirmed at the end of the war. And I guess I use the word war because that's the word we use, but we should say that in that war, 1,250 Iraqi people were killed for every one American. 125 Americans were killed, so you can do the math. You're NYU students. You know what that the other side of that equation is. Thousands, hundreds of thousands of Iraqi people were killed. And the sanctions were reaffirmed. Even though Iraq had been expelled from Kuwait and the victory that the U.S. had sought in that war had been achieved, they got Kuwait back. Kuwait being one of the most important sources of oil in the world. It's a Gulf state that the U.S. controls with basically one ruling family and a tremendous amount of poverty. That's basically how the place works. The cold calculus behind the economic sanctions, which Bill Clinton said would remain in place until the end of time or as long as Saddam Hussein is in power, the cold calculus is as simple as it is barbaric. Economic pressure on civilians will translate into political pressure on Saddam Hussein, and that will force a change. This, of course, you know, this, now we're in more than 10 years of this policy. That change has not been forced. So morally bankrupt to the point of obscenity and maybe even absurdity, the sanctions have led to what a UN study called a humanitarian disaster comparable to the worst catastrophes of the past decades. While a tiny elite in Iraq, including Saddam Hussein and the party that he's a leader of, ordinary Iraqi people are dying in numbers that defy comprehension, in staggering numbers, from malnutrition and from all manner of waterborne disease. In a study conducted a few years ago, UNICEF found, that's the UN program for children, UNICEF found that the mortality rate for children under age 5 in South and Central Iraq had doubled since the sanctions were imposed. In a country of 22 million people, this equals roughly 500,000 children dying since the imposition of sanctions. The number one killer of children in Iraq today is dehydration from diarrhea. South and Central Iraq, notably, are also two of the areas of the country most heavily bombarded by the United States during the campaign against Iraq. 1 million rounds of depleted uranium-tipped rounds were fired there. The U.S. embargo, like that on Cuba, prevents any item that might have what's called a dual use, any item that could be conceivably used for a military purpose, from being allowed into Iraq. These include ambulances, chlorinators, which is what would be necessary to make water drinkable, and pencils. And there are all kinds of incredible stories of people who have gone there, who go to schools and watch teachers stand in schoolrooms, and literally no one in the room has a pencil or a piece of paper. In an interview, the London journalist John Pilger, who maybe some of you have gotten to know his work recently, there's been a lot of his stuff on the internet, he had a conversation with Peter von Welsum, who's the chair of the United Nations Sanctions Committee. And this, it went like this. John Pilger says, "How much power does the United States exercise over your committee?" This is the independent UN committee. "How much power does the U.S. exercise?" Van Welsum says, "We operate by consensus." And Pilger says, "And what if the Americans object?" And Van Welsum says, "We don't operate." So, and that's from the head of the committee himself. The politics of starving Iraq into submission suggests nothing so much as some of the stuff that we were hearing from Todd about the policy the U.S. followed in Vietnam for many, many years, which was in that instance called bombing the city to save it, right? You destroy a country in order to save it from itself. That's sort of the policy of Iraq. Cruel, immoral, and viciously reactionary, then as now. I believe fundamentally that's this kind of policy, and Christian just mentioned this, it's this kind of policy pursued in Iraq and also in the region more generally that contributed to a climate in which 7,000 Americans were murdered a month ago. And that's important, and that's got nothing to do with justifying what happened. It has everything to do with trying to create some way to move forward with meaning and with understanding of the world that we live in. And it's those kind of policies we have to fight if we actually want a safe world, if we see ourselves as citizens of the world, not just of New York City, if we care about everybody being safe, not just ourselves, but even if we just care about ourselves being safe, I think we also have to fight these kind of policies. I'm missing a page. Hold on a sec. Okay. I'm going to shift gears a little because I have to cover a lot of stuff and I don't have much time. So I'm just going to jump into some of the stuff that I think is really important for people to be thinking about as they think about U.S. policy in the region. 11% of the world's proven oil resources are underneath Iraq, and that makes it just second to Saudi Arabia. It's the second largest source of oil in the world. It's close to the surface, so it's among the cheapest to extract and refine, making it therefore much more profitable. And of course, we know the region and the world in terms of access to the Persian Gulf and transportation and markets is also critical. As long ago as 1945, the State Department said that oil has played a larger part in the external relations of the U.S. than any other commodity. So while keeping the world safe for the consumption of SUVs is really one part of this equation, it's really wrong just to think about this being like there's a direct line between all of us and the cars we drive and U.S. policy. That's a part of it, and I think any sustainable, any fight against U.S. policy has to include thinking about sustainable energy and the ridiculousness of how Americans consume cars. Not just Americans, but definitely Americans. But that's not really the only part of it. A big, you know, other part of it is the geopolitics, the idea of strategy in competition among really the capitalist world, in competition among states and countries that want to have geopolitical control of areas, regions, resources. This is what world wars are about, and this is what policy is about pretty much everywhere. And there are some problems with this, which I'll try and touch on if I have time, but in general, it's pretty much a rule. Taking control of the region from England, the United States has really taken control of the oil resources in the region from England since World War II and has just been engaged in a total policy to prevent Japan and the Soviet Union, which now is not quite a player in the same way, from getting access to it. And this is where Afghanistan is really critical and South Asia is really critical. And the war, U.S., you know, the proxy war that the U.S. and the Soviet Union fought in Afghanistan is absolutely a part of that, too. 51% of the crude oil of Afghanistan comes to the United States. 19.5 million barrels per day of oil, and this is still happening now. I guess this is sort of interrupted now because of the economic embargo. The United States Energy Information Administration has said that by the year 2020, 64%, that's their projection, that we will be so much more efficient in extracting Afghani oil that and we'll have better diplomatic relations that we will be able to access actually 64% of the natural resources of that country. The Caspian region, according to all predictions, and Afghanistan is sort of considered the part of the Caspian region for purposes of this dialogue, might be the richest yet. It might actually be on a par with the Persian Gulf. They can't really prove oil is there. They have a tremendous amount of sophisticated things that they do to try and understand what kind of resources are available. But there are definitely experts who think that this is might be one of the richest sources of oil. But it is the third largest source of natural gas, Turkmenistan, which, again, Christian was talking about, and the role of UNICAL in the region, has been trying, in cooperation with the Saudi Arabian regime, for years to be able to create a pipeline that goes right through Afghanistan to get the natural gas of Turkmenistan to the Gulf, where it can transport it to world markets. Projections say that the Caspian Basin alone could have enough energy to sustain the United States for 30 years or more. Dick Cheney said just about 3 years ago, "I cannot think of a time when we have had a region emerge as suddenly to become as strategically significant as the Caspian." So while this is by no means the only story there is to tell about what's happening now, and particularly because there was this huge thing that happened in this country, it's nonetheless really important to understand the playing field on which we operate and in which U.S. policy takes place. And now I'm going to shift a little to talk more broadly about the region, not specific to oil so much, but to actually military policy. As in the case of the United States trying to create a coalition in this instance, to gang up the whole world against the terror networks, as they call them, in the Gulf War, the United States did create a coalition, and in doing so, they made a really pivotal shift in policy that had been the post-war policy until that period of time. Part of that is because it coincided with the collapse of the Soviet Union, so the whole Cold War framework that had structured diplomatic and military policy in the world didn't exist anymore. But partly it's the end of sort of nationalistic radical movements in the countries of the Middle East, so the U.S. had access to a kind of politics, pro-capitalist politics, that they hadn't had for decades before. So there are a lot of things that contribute to it, but nonetheless, what's important to say is that what has happened in the past decade is a fundamental shift in what the U.S. is able to accomplish in the region, and we've actually heard a lot about this because we've heard Osama bin Laden talk about the U.S. military presence in Saudi Arabia, which is, for the most part, a new, you know, in historical terms, a new thing. In particular, Jordan, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia all reconfigured their relationships to the U.S. since the Gulf War. Saudi allowed military bases in the U.S. conducted the war against Iraq from bases in part in Saudi Arabia, also in Turkey, another, you know, beacon of democracy in the world. Since the end of the war, Saudi Arabia has received more than $12 billion worth of arms and arms transfers and arms loans from the United States. I don't know how many of you know this, but when the United States gives somebody a loan, gives a country a loan to buy defense aid, it's called that when they give a country a loan to buy weapons, you know, defense stuff, the requirement is that you buy American-made stuff. Like, you're not allowed to buy it anywhere else. The deal is if you get the cash, you have to buy American-made weapons, which is going to become important in this story in just a minute in a different way. Jordan has received more than $4 billion in aid from the United States. And Egypt, as I think probably some of you know, is actually the second highest recipient of U.S. aid in the entire world, getting more than $2.5 billion per year on a regular line item for military and economic aid. So this is a lot of money, right? Like, this is a lot of money. And I think that while all of these, we don't have time tonight to talk about the differences among the regimes in these countries and the sort of differences of U.S. policy in relationship to them, and there are important differences. I'm not trying to suggest that that's not the case or to say that there's this big thing called the Arab world that you can only understand, you know, as a bloc. We have to study it and think about it carefully. But there is something important to say about the policy perspective that the United States has been pursuing in the region for the past decade. There's a really simple thing that kind of unites it, which is that the United States is really interested in having regimes operating there which are totally internally brutal and repressive and totally externally weak and dependent. This is a really thing that's really kind of a unifying theme in the regimes in the region. And they're extraordinary stories. I mean, Todd was talking about how policy changed for soldiers in the Gulf War, and one of the most important things that happened was that in the Gulf War, American soldiers were totally segregated from the Saudi people. The bases were there, and there were thousands and thousands of soldiers in Saudi Arabia, but they were totally segregated from the Saudi people. And one of the reasons for that was that during Vietnam, soldiers who came to oppose the war, many of them said they did it on the basis of getting to know the Vietnamese people. They simply couldn't continue doing what they were supposed to do when they were recognizing that Vietnamese people were people. So that phenomenon is really important part of it, and I'm glad Todd talked about some of that stuff. So the question of external weakness is a really complicated one, because on the one hand, these are countries that, you know, have pretty substantial armies in many instances, substantial weapons, because they get them from the United States, so they're good, right? We know that. And they're also countries that are really deeply, deeply involved with the IMF and World Bank institutions that many of you in this room know much more about than I do. So there's an interesting kind of complex structure of creating dependency on the U.S., but which also creates a kind of weakness. The closer the relationship, in my view, the weaker the relationship from the point of view of any kind of independence of those countries. And that's important, because what would it look like if there were democracy in any of those countries? What might that mean for who gets access to what resources? What might that mean for the fact that 19.5 million barrels of oil per day leave Afghanistan and come to the United States for consumption in a country that is now one of the most poor in the world, where 6% of the people have electricity, where 2.5 million people have been made refugees, 6 million internally displaced? It's pretty staggering to think about. So there's a calculation that's important to know. So of course, within the whole framework of U.S. policy in the Middle East, there's a really important exception that we have to talk about for a minute, and then I'll wrap up. And that exception to the rule is Israel. The Israeli lobby, which is one of the largest and most powerful in the United States, boasts of what it calls a special relationship between the U.S. and Israel. And it's interesting because the Israeli lobby gets very upset when anybody else other than them uses the term special relationship. But I do use it because I think it's indeed a very special relationship. Israel, a country with a population of about 6 million people, which is a little bit bigger than the state of New Jersey, is the largest recipient of U.S. aid in the world. As I said before, Egypt gets $2.5 billion per year. Israel gets $5 billion per year annually from the United States. And as we know, when they experience crises, like of this past year, more cash, $450 million more in the past year, additional money for covering up for like the loss of tourism and stuff, gets kicked their way pretty much without even a ripple in the U.S. public. It's actually the case now that Colombia, where the U.S. is pursuing Plan Colombia in the so-called war on drugs, is actually closing in on getting $5 billion in aid because of the war there. So there's now a sort of sad, fucked up parallel happening. But nonetheless, there's a staggering fact of U.S. aid to Israel. It's also the case that Israel is the only country in the world that, when it gets defense money from the United States, is allowed to buy its own weapons. It's not held to the same standard as every other country in the world who are required to buy American-made weapons. So as a result, Israel has been able to develop an economy based on arms production. It's itself a nuclear power, and also to become major players in the world arms market, which during the period of sanctions on the apartheid regime in South Africa, for example, was really important to their economy and to South Africans' survival. Israel is one of the only countries in the world given the green light by the United States to pursue a policy of political assassination. Israel has assassinated 19 suspected terrorists in the past year. And this is actually, if you read the New York Times, like it's in the headlines, you know, Israel assassinated somebody else. Like it's fine. You know, it's just everybody thinks, you know, guilt by association, guilt by ethnicity, guilt by the fact of being a refugee in the West Bank. It's a policy there. And it's interesting to be talking at this, on the same panel as Christian, because several of those high-tech assassinations have actually happened via cell phones. They've been able to rig people's cell phones and kill them that way. So I really just want to wrap up by saying a few things about just one other part, if I can find my place here, about one other... Well, no, I guess I... Okay, sorry. When I lived in the Israeli-occupied territories, which was before the peace process began, I lived for a while in a refugee camp in the Gaza Strip, and the Gaza Strip is now one of the most, if not the most, crowded places on Earth. More than 1 million people live there without adequate sewage as refugees, which means they don't have homes. They live in tents or in corrugated metal homes or, in some instances, homes made of cement. The policy there for, you know, the policy for What am I trying to say? I'm getting upset. Anyone who has been a suicide bomber, a Palestinian suicide bomber, who has thus lost their life in the attack, his family, his home is demolished. The policy in Israel is that your home is demolished in retaliation for a crime. Your whole family is collectively punished. And this has been a policy that Israel has pursued since 1967. For anybody who's a terrorist or an activist, if you go to prison for a crime or you're held into administrative detention or you're considered having participated in, there's no trials. So I'm trying to use language that indicates that this is all guilt by fact of there are no trials whatsoever of anybody. Palestinian people haven't had that legal right. People's homes are demolished. So the Gaza Strip is a place where you don't just live in tents and in corrugated metal homes, but you also live around a lot of rubble and a lot of homes that have been demolished. And this has actually been before the ceasefire, which took place after September 18th or something. Israel went in and demolished a massive number of homes of people who are suspected supporters of Hamas under the rubric of weeding out and destroying the terrorist networks. So there's sort of a new crisis in the Gaza Strip in particularly. But I want to talk about this because I want to use it as an opportunity to segue into what I'm going to end with, which is that when I lived in the Gaza Strip or when I was there, I didn't live there for very long, children had a practice of collecting used tear gas canisters that they found in the street. And this was during the Palestinian uprising, so there were a tremendous amount of military clashes. There were huge numbers of soldiers in the villages and in the refugee camps all the time. And they would line them up in rows and keep them in their rooms and show them to you. And on those tear gas canisters, they all said, "Made in the USA, Salzburg, Pennsylvania." And this fact remains for me an unforgettable and unshakable call to action against the despicable and vicious presence of the U.S. military in the world. By 1996, the United States controlled more than 45% of the global arms market. This number rises every day. The military budget of this country is $334 billion per year. Per year. $334 billion per year. Spending on nuclear weapons alone amounts to 1% of the total federal budget annually. I compare this to the fact that the federal budget for welfare, less than 2% of the budget, was slashed in the mid-1990s by the Clinton administration in order to get lazy women and their presumably lazy children off of the dole. But, you know, what about the dole, right? Like, who is it that gets what for free in this country? Well, the top 10 U.S. military contractors in this country receive $47 billion per year from the United States government, including such notables as Raytheon, who makes the Patriot and the Hawk missiles, $6.5 billion a year. Lockheed Martin makes the F-16 and the Apache and the Trident, $12.7 billion a year. Boeing makes the Comanche, $11.5 billion a year, for producing nothing useful. Nothing useful. Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and TRW spent $35 million in lobbying in 1997. Why? Anybody know the answer? Those are the four biggest recipients of Star Wars Strategic Defense Initiative missile contracts. So why, in a world in which the United States controls 45% of the global arms market, has the largest army, most powerful army perhaps ever known on the history of this planet, needs a strategic missile system, is sort of unfathomable. And of course, Dick Cheney sits on the TRW board, and his wife, Lynn Cheney, sits on the board of Lockheed Martin. And I'm not going to go into the list of elected officials and non-elected influential people in this country who make up those boards and boardrooms, but you know the picture. And we can talk about that more if you want. So I'm just going to conclude by saying that somebody who I admire very much once said that it's the job of those of us who are trying to make a better world to be as radical as reality. And I think that I actually like that. I was reading a little book called The Survival Guide before I came over here, which is a book that was published by some young people, students in Sarajevo, when they were trying to survive the siege of their city, when they couldn't leave and they couldn't really survive staying there. And they wrote a book about that experience. And the last words of the book are, "Despise, don't hate." And I think that that's really important. So for me, it's like the two things that I want, like, you guys to leave here with tonight are those two ideas, that everybody here should leave as radical as reality, which you only had to listen to Todd, or you only had to listen to Christian, or you only had to listen to me, and now you've heard all three, to know is pretty fucking radical. Reality is pretty crazy. And it's also not a world in which any of us are going to be safe, and it's certainly not a world in which there's any kind of freedom going on of the kind we want. And so I just urge everybody to keep doing and fighting in all the ways that you have been, and I look forward to the discussion. Thank you.